to get an update from Dee Dee. By now, we were on a first-name basis. "The doctor's already been by," Dee Dee told me. "He talked to your mom and Avery. She wasn't callous, but she was brisk. This was her everyday work environment, caring for people very ill or close to death, talking to their relatives or loved ones, carrying out the doctor's orders. John's ICU room was as quiet but busy as ever. Cleaners and nurses and lab workers, the food tray delivery man, all came in and out of the room. The pink-smocked volunteer lady with the cart of books and newspapers stuck her head in and whispered, 'Do you need something to read?' I raised my book in answer, and she nodded and vanished. Other patients' visitors passed the doorway regularly. Their faces, too, had become familiar. There was the very old man who walked with a cane and a familiar-looking woman in her 60s who looked more worn down every day. This morning, the weary-looking woman whose child was two doors down was crying as she walked by. I shuddered. There was too much pain here. I had to block it out. Thank God I had a good book. I was the lucky recipient of John's allocated lunch tray, which, of course, he couldn't eat. The cornbread was dry, the banana pudding was okay, the grapes were a little rubbery but still had a good flavor. The meat, which might have been beef, and the vegetables, overcooked to the maximum, were better left untouched. At least I no longer felt guilty about my extravagant breakfast. I finished my book. I was getting stiff, so I walked around the ICU for a few circuits. I paused at each big window to look out at the parking lot at the front, or at the quieter employee lot and utility buildings at the back. Then I resumed my watch in John's room. I began to work on a crossword puzzle, glancing up at John's silent figure from time to time. When I got bored with that, when I got stuck, I closed my eyes and tried to meditate. But I have never been good at letting go of myself. Before very long, I abandoned the meditation and started flipping through the magazine I'd left. I didn't have to remember a plot if I was studying red carpet dresses worn by women I didn't know. Even celebrity gossip palled. I laid the magazine on the wheeled table beside my chair. I simply looked at John. I recalled introducing him to my mother. She'd been dubious at first. John had some interests she didn't share, but John's pleasant manners and intelligence had gradually won her over. Plus, truth be told, John was a good-looking man. I smiled as I thought of this. And since I was watching John, I saw his eyelids flicker. I leaped to my feet, knocking all my reading material to the floor. "John," I said, trying to keep my voice low and even, but I couldn't suppress my excitement. The muscles in his cheeks and lips moved as if he were trying to form a word. I was sure he heard me and knew who I was. He whispered, "Ro." Then Nurse Dee Dee hurried in and blocked him from my sight. Some reading on his monitor had changed. When she moved to the side, I could see his eyes had closed again, but there were muscles moving under the skin. My mother would never forgive me if I didn't tell her about this development. John had spoken. I wanted to stay in the room because John might talk to me again, but I couldn't phone from ICU. Dee Dee made the decision for me. She asked me to leave while she did something personal for John. I raced out of the ICU, cell phone in hand, and took the elevator to the lobby. I punched my mother's speed dial. I could tell she was awake, either again or she'd never slept. "Mother, his eyes opened, just for a minute. He said my name," I told her. "I'm on my way." I returned to John's room, feeling nothing but excitement and happiness. This development was more than I'd ever hoped for. Dee Dee had left. John and I were alone again. I stood by the bed watching him. His eyes flickered open once or twice, and he always looked directly at my face. After 10 minutes had passed, Mother appeared at the other side of John's bed. She wasn't there, and then she was. She looked like hell, but there was some hope on her face. She took his hand. "Honey," she said, her voice steady. "I'm here." John heard her and knew her. His fingers moved slightly in hers, and he smiled for a moment. When I glanced at my watch, I realized it was time for me to return to Sophie. If Mother was sitting with John now, maybe I could go home, feed her there, and avoid the awkwardness of public breastfeeding. But I didn't want to leave Mother alone, since I didn't know what would happen if and when John returned to full consciousness. I assumed he would be in a lot of pain and possibly very anxious. I was relieved to see John David waving at me from the nurse's station. Problem solved. I hugged Mother and whispered, "I have to leave. Call me if anything changes." I turned away to gather up my belongings and reach down for my diaper bag. It wasn't there. I simply couldn't believe it. I looked around the room, sure I'd see it at any moment. Perhaps it had gotten in the way of one of the staff who'd set it in another place. It wasn't in the room. I glanced at the nurse's station to see that John David was getting increasingly anxious to see his father. I could hardly make a big to-do about a diaper bag at this moment. It just wouldn't be right. So I left John's room with my head up and my book and other items tucked under my arm. "He's waking up," I told John David, smiling for all I was worth. Before I could say boo to a goose, John David was standing by my mother at John's bedside. His face was full of hope. It seemed to me that having people gathering around you, really hoping you lived, was the greatest testament to your life. And abruptly, I was back to the mundane. I stopped by the nurse's station. "Dee Dee," I said, "I hate to tell you this, but my bag was just stolen from John's room while I was downstairs telephoning." She looked up at me with no comprehension, just at first. Then she was dismayed. "Out of a patient's room?" she said, disgusted. "I'm really sorry. I hope you didn't have much in it." "My driver's license," I said. Thank God I'd put my car keys in my pocket. The bag was actually for my daughter's stuff, because I thought Robin would be bringing her here. I described it to Dee Dee in case someone found the discarded bag somewhere in the building. Who should I tell about this?
"Officer Rodenheiser. His office is on the second floor," Nurse Tallchief said with a significant smile.
"He's really nice," Nurse Stanley added, grinning.
Dee Dee shook her head. "They're just trying to tell you he's quite a man. He'll be back on active duty soon, and we're sure gonna miss him."
I got directions to track down Officer Rodenheiser, necessary because this hospital was confusing, even for a Lawrenceton native. I only took one wrong turn at pediatrics before I found the correct doorway. It was easy to see why the nurses were so enthusiastic. Brad Rodenheiser was tall and blonde. He clearly got some exercise. Quite a bit of exercise. His eyes were blue and steady. Well, wow. When he got up, I noticed he had a brace on his knee. That's why he'd been off active duty. Brad Rodenheiser wasn't all about the good looks. He struck me as a capable policeman. Within a couple of minutes, he'd called up a form on his computer and started filling it in. "I gather this happens often," I said.
"All the time,"
he rumbled.
"Date of birth?"
I gave him the information he needed.
"I'm afraid the chance of getting your bag back intact is very slim, but I'm sure you figured that out."
Officer Rodenheiser handed me a copy of my report. I started to put it away, then remembered I had nothing to put it in.
"People take personal belongings from the patient's rooms. They steal medical supplies off the carts. They grab scrubs out of the dressing rooms. Even food, if you can believe it. At least the drugs are locked up and heavily monitored."
The hospital was a den of iniquity, not the place of respite and calm I'd thought it. It was disillusioning, but not a shock. The diaper bag was a gift. We're really fond of the people who gave it to us.
I can fall back on another one, but this is kind of special.
I almost felt like apologizing that my loss was so trivial.
All the way home, I thought about the theft. In the grand scheme of things, it wasn't a big deal at all. But I was upset in a hurt way, and I was upset in an angry way. Two sides of the same reaction.
I strode, if a person of my height can stride, into the house, not knowing which stance to take. And I made the bad choice of trying both of them.
Robin was sitting in the living room with Sophie, who was just beginning to fuss.
"Look," he told Sophie brightly. "There's Mama. Yahoo! Food!"
"Robin," I said tragically, "my bag got stolen." His eyes went first to my huge leather bag sitting slumped in a corner of the kitchen counter.
He almost told me it was right there
before he thought twice.
"Your bag,"
he said cautiously. "The diaper bag," I said. "The striped green one with the designer emblem on it."
"The diaper bag got stolen,"
he repeated, as if verifying my information. Luckily, I was able to restrain myself.
"Yes," I said through gritted teeth.
"From the hospital room, just now." At least I had my keys in my pocket.
Robin could tell I wasn't going to take the baby from him until I got a reaction, so he hurried to supply one. "And no one saw anything?"
His voice was an appropriate blend of disbelief and outrage.
"Someone came in the room when John was by himself?"
"Apparently," I said, and described my trip downstairs to call Mother.
"So John's awake," Robin said. "That's great. But the bag getting stolen, incredible. I'm sure you called the police. What did they say?"
I was getting myself under control by then. "There was a policeman right there in the hospital. He told me things go missing all the time, and he wrote down a description of the bag," I said. "Maybe the thief will drop it in a garbage can at the hospital or somewhere outside when he's been through it."
"That would be great," Robin agreed, feeling it was safe to hand Sophie to me now. "Though, you know, well, I'm sure that was the very best bag, but we got another one from Jeff's wife. It's on the shelf in Sophie's closet."
"I remember," I said, and realized I sounded ridiculous and petty.
"Time to shut up."
I sat down with Sophie and pulled up my t-shirt, unsnapping the nursing bra. It was the most unexciting piece of lingerie I'd ever worn in my life, and I'm not someone who collects pretty lingerie.
If I had to be honest, I didn't, but I was going to.
The green and white bag had seemed a little pretentious to me. A designer label on a baby bag? And the fact that it really didn't look like a diaper bag had not been a recommendation in my eyes. Why shouldn't it look like what it was?
Robin was still looking for ways to be helpful. "While you were feeding Sophie, walk through the scene in your mind. Maybe you can picture who was outside the room when you left with your phone."
I was pretty excited and intent on getting to a place where I could call Mother, but it can't hurt to try. While Sophie partook of refreshment, I closed my eyes and tried to recreate the scene. I stepped out of John's room. There was the orderly who usually bathed and shaved John, a little guy with a lot of tattoos. There were the nurses going in and out of the circular desk area. Most of them were familiar to me by sight. There'd been one I hadn't seen before, a stout woman with iron gray hair and a serious overbite. But she'd been talking to a woman I did know, so she must have checked out okay with the other nurses. And she had all the requisite accoutrements: aqua scrubs, heavy sneakers, a lanyard around her neck with an ID tag, a chart in her hand. If she wasn't the real thing, she was a master of camouflage. There'd been a doctor sitting at the little desk in a cubbyhole designed for doctors to enter their notes and instructions in privacy. Dark-skinned and clean-shaven. That's all I'd been able to see. He'd been bent over his work like he knew what he was doing. Had he had on a lanyard or a name tag? His back had been to me. I couldn't have seen one. Aside from that, there was a woman walking away from the room. I listed all the passersby to Robin, who was still hovering. That woman was maybe in her 40s. She had short brown hair, wearing a skirt and blouse. I'll bet she was a relative, but none of the people I saw looked like purse thieves. I scanned my brain a bit more. Nope, that's all I've got.
It's amazing you can remember that much, Robin said, obviously surprised that his suggestion had proved so fruitful. Shouldn't the hospital have security cameras?
They do.
I told Robin about Officer Brad Rodenheiser's office, trying not to sound too wistful.
The cameras are mostly pointed at the entrances and exits, so there might be some record of someone leaving with my bag.
I felt more cheerful.
Thanks, honey. Good idea.
I'm brimming with them, he said, smiling. I'll call the hospital, if that's okay with you.
Actually, I have his card. You can call that number.
Robin gave me a narrow-eyed look, but took the card and called the number. Robin had to leave a message, but within 10 minutes, Brad Rodenheiser called back.
I'm Robin Crusoe. My wife's bag was stolen there just an hour or so ago. She talked to you.
Pause.
Yes, the short woman with all the hair and the pink glasses.
Pause.
Yes, it was a diaper bag, not an actual purse, but it was a valued gift. Plus, you know, it's hers.
Pause.
I'm absolutely certain you have more serious crimes to investigate.
Robin agreed.
But if this person stole from my wife in the ICU unit, he'll steal more. Maybe already has. We were wondering if she could watch some security recordings. Oh, you were just about to...
Pause.
Well, that's great. Please, let us know.
He ended the call.
Ro, he says no one has turned it in at the hospital. He was just about to review the security footage to see if someone was caught on camera leaving with your bag. If he sees something interesting, he'll call you in to look at it.
Robin seemed a little miffed at being anticipated by the policeman.
That's the best we could hope for, I guess. I told Sophie, get used to it, little one. You have to be tough in this world.
I was surprised when Robin's phone rang 15 minutes later.
You're not going to believe this, but he has someone on camera,
Robin said.
Let's go.
The second Sophie finished and we changed her diaper, we were on our way back to the hospital with the slightly less wonderful baby bag, hastily stocked on my shoulder. I wasn't able to take Robin directly to the little office. I took a wrong turn at radiology, but I only had to repeat a little part of the route. The door was open. Officer Rodenheiser was seated at the console, and Detective Kathy Trumbull stood behind him. She wore her usual tailored pants, this time a navy blue, a blue and green floral blouse, and a green jacket, which almost covered the badge and gun she clipped to her belt. Dressed for business as usual.
I was not glad to see her.
Brad here called me, she said by way of greeting. He remembered you were involved in the Tracy Beale case.
It happened on our property, I said. That's the extent of our involvement.
Kathy ignored my protest.
I've reviewed the footage very quickly, she said. Brad pointed out this one, and I agree this is the most interesting.
She pointed from her position behind the seated Officer Rodenheiser. We scooted behind the console so we could watch. There were two computer screens, each showing four separate areas in the building. The pictures were black and white, but the definition was good. Kathy pointed to the upper right-hand corner of the left screen. We were watching a series of people walking in and out of the main entrance. A couple involved in an intense discussion came in. A very old man with a cane made his way out very slowly, followed by a woman in jeans and a plaid shirt pushing a child in a wheelchair. A man in a suit and tie walked into the lobby briskly, obviously deep in his own thoughts. Then two nurses in animated conversation left, followed right on their heels by a tall, dark man in scrubs with a bag over his shoulder. A striped bag. I clutched Robin's arm.
That may be the man I saw in the ICU unit, I said. He was sitting in the carrel where the doctors write their notes or whatever it is they do.
What did he look like?
Kathy was poised to pounce. Like the footage. I only saw his back.
Well, that's something. We know the person who took your bag is about an inch over 6 feet, African-American male, and he owns a set of scrubs.
And he knows how to blend in,
Robin offered. Why would he want my diaper bag? I wasn't thinking very swiftly today.
It was the only bag you had.
I didn't get Kathy's implication.
I'm sure he thought it was your purse,
Robin said. No one else in the ICU is missing a bag?
I had a strong feeling I already knew the answer.
No, Kathy said.
Only your bag was taken.
What was in it? Diapers, because it's a diaper bag, I said, exasperated. Baby wipes, a shawl to cover me if I have to feed Sophie in public, a spit-up rag, an extra sleeper, a plastic toy, maybe a bib. And today, worse luck, I put my license in the outer pocket because I didn't want to carry my purse as well.
What was he after?
Kathy asked, apparently herself, because she was looking into space. Then she fixed her eyes on me.
Come down to the station, she said abruptly.
Chapter 14.
Why?
I was taken aback.
There's some pictures you could look at. See if you could spot your fake doctor.
I took a deep breath. I don't know how else to say this, Kathy. I didn't see his face. I saw his back. I'm not going to accuse someone on the basis of his back.
Robin held Sophie pressed against his shoulder. She was asleep. That was one good thing.
Up to you,
he said. He wasn't any happier than I was, but he let the decision be mine. Kathy, I protested. You know I can't identify him.
Knowing that, why did she want me to go through this charade? I could only figure she believed one of the pictures would spark a memory.
Brad Rodenheiser looked from Kathy to me to Robin. He seemed highly entertained.
Watching people come and go on four screens and or answering an occasional call from some location in the hospital must offer limited entertainment.
I was tired of being questioned, tired of being at the beck and call of the police, and most of all, unhappy that the problem still existed. I wanted the murderer to be caught. I wanted to see Virginia, know she was safe. I realized that in the grand scheme of things, I had little to complain about. After all, Sophie and I were safe. Gossip might nip at Robin's heels, but he couldn't be considered a serious suspect in Tracy's murder.
All right, I said abruptly. No matter what Kathy's scheme might be, I had to do everything I could to resolve the situation.
Robin, can you take Sophie home? Philip texted me a minute ago, so I know he's there.
Then you can come to the law enforcement complex to bring me home. This shouldn't take long.
I gave Kathy a pointed look.
You sure you want to do this?
Robin said, doubt heavy in his voice.
I wasn't sure, not at all. But if doing what Kathy wanted would get us closer to the truth, I would oblige.
See you in a few.
Robin bent to kiss me, and I patted Sophie's bottom very gently. Then they left, with the backup diaper bag. I watched them go, already regretting my decision. While I thought my own thoughts, Kathy watched the man walk out of the hospital over and over.
Kathy left the room to make a phone call, she said, and while I waited for her, I had an unexpected conversation with Brad Rodenheiser.
She's a little thorny now,
he said, nodding his head at the doorway Kathy had gone through.
What's wrong with her? She's so different, I said in as low a voice as I could manage.
He looked a little surprised.
You don't know about her sister?
No. I was at sea.
Annette's in the psych ward here, had a breakdown.
But then Kathy came back in, looked at us suspiciously, and snapped. I think we're ready to go now.
Sure, I said.
And trotted out of the hospital in her wake after thanking Officer Rodenheiser. He was just doing his job, Kathy said over her shoulder as we made our way to the main entrance. You don't have to thank him for that. I didn't respond because I simply didn't need to justify myself to Kathy Trumbull. When had she turned from a friendly acquaintance to a cranky, secretive grouch? I couldn't understand what had happened to make her change so drastically. There was no way I was going to ask her, not while she was so touchy. Having a sick sister simply didn't seem likely to have affected this personality alteration. It felt very strange to walk outside with empty hands. I didn't think I'd done it in years. I was always carrying something. A purse, grocery bags, books, a diaper bag, a baby. I found it liberating. We walked around the fountain. Its central statue was supposed to represent the first female doctor in Lawrenceton, which accounted for its location close to the entrance. There were the usual rows of parking, and around the perimeter was a fringe of side-by-side parking spaces that encircled the whole lot. Kathy's car was parked in one of those spaces, nosed into a stand of scrub and trees. Directly behind the trees were long-established smaller homes. Since the garages of these bungalows were one car, the streets were often crowded with vehicles. It was mid-afternoon now. A lot of people were still at work. Kathy's car was not a black-and-white patrol unit, but an unmarked blue SUV, conspicuously clean. I went to the passenger side, waiting to hear the thunk of the lock going up. When it didn't happen, I peered across the hood at Kathy. She was staring back the way we'd come. Of course, I turned to look, too. A very old man with a cane was making his slow way toward us, holding a green and white striped bag in his free hand. He looked vaguely familiar, and I thought I'd seen him in the ICU. The bag didn't have its pleasing cylindrical shape any longer. It was clearly empty.
Young lady, he said when he got close enough. Is this yours?
Kathy muttered some words I'd never heard out loud. I hoped the old gentleman hadn't heard them.
Yes, sir, I said, delighted. Where did you find it?
It was down on the ground by my car. I saw the name Tea Garden in it, and I knew that it must be you, because you are the spitting image of your grandmother. I seen you in the ICU. Didn't cost me nothing to come over here and ask.
People tell me I'm like my grandmother pretty often, I said, smiling. I'm Aurora.
Carter Redding,
he said, extending his blue-veined hand to mine to hand over the bag. Kathy snatched it as he was handing it over.
I'll have to print that zipper, she said.
Can you just check that outside pocket to see if my driver's license is still there?
That's not the most important thing here, Kathy said. Mr. Redding gave her an indignant look before he turned back to me.
Was it stole from you? He said.
Yes, sir, it was, while I was visiting my mother's husband in the ICU, I said.
My daughter's up there, he said. She's got the cancer.
I opened my mouth to tell him I was sorry, but several things happened in an instant. I heard two loud cracks. I was looking around in bewilderment when Carter Redding grabbed my elbow and said,
Get down,
in a no-nonsense voice. Kathy pulled her gun. She crouched at the rear bumper of the SUV and pointed down with an emphatic finger.
Stay there, behind the engine block, she ordered us. Don't move.
I was baffled, but I was obedient. She pulled her radio off her belt.
Shots fired. Shots fired. North side of the hospital parking lot. Code SOS, Brad.
Instituting code SOS,
replied Brad Rodenheiser calmly. And I was still thinking, what? I heard multiple voices raised in panic. I realized I was huddling with my hands protecting my head, a foolish posture if there ever was one. There was another shot, followed instantly by a shrill scream of pain.
Someone's down,
said Mr. Redding grimly. And finally, I understood. I was too frightened to speak. I spared a second to think how glad I was that Robin and Sophie had gone home. Mr. Redding was shaking like a leaf, but he was keeping himself together. If it hadn't been for Mr. Redding, I might still have been standing up and looking around in confusion. Thanks, said, but my voice came out in a gasp.
Been a long time, but you don't forget that sound, he said.
Obviously, crouching was painful for the elderly man, and the shock hadn't been good for him. His breathing was harsh.
I need to get back into my daughter,
Mr. Redding said, and began to pull up on the door handle of the SUV, struggling to stand. His cane lay on the ground, forgotten.
No, sir, Kathy said. The hospital is locked down now, so no one in or out. Your daughter's much safer than we are.
I tried to regain control of myself. Kathy had clipped her radio to her belt. She held her gun with both hands. I couldn't see anyone else moving. A car alarm went off. The persistent honk was maddening. When it stopped, I let out a deep breath. After that, the parking lot, which had been full of people coming and going minutes earlier, fell still. There was another crack. It seemed to echo in the silence. Then a woman began screaming, screaming as if she would never stop. Mr. Redding's color had worsened. He didn't seem to be completely in the here and now.
I have to get back to Kathleen, he mumbled.
Mr. Redding, we're going to stay here for now, I said, in as low a voice as I could manage. I don't know who I thought would hear me, the big bad wolf, but I felt the strong conviction I should stay as small and still as possible. This must be how a rabbit felt when it heard a fox in the woods, or a wolf. Now, sporadically, voices were coming over the radio. Kathy, looking to her right around the back of the SUV, was trying to answer the incoming law.
On scene, said a new voice calmly. Moving west to intercept. Status?
Kathy responded.
Shots came from close to the entrance. I'm behind my car with two citizens. Possible victims. Screaming heard. Location unknown.
The wail of sirens grew closer. From where I crouched, I could only see a little to the northeast. I caught movement from the corner of my eye. Susan Crawford, in uniform, was duck walking from car to car, a little awkwardly because she was pregnant. She had her radio in her left hand, her handgun in her right. She did not hesitate. She didn't acknowledge our presence, but I was sure she knew we were there. After peering from behind a Ford Fiesta, she moved right behind a mid-size red car, maybe a Nissan. I saw her lips move, and over Kathy's radio, I heard Susan say,
I see him. Suspect's behind the Dr. Brennan statue. White male, teens, blonde, blue shirt, brown pants, maybe 5'8". Moving into position.
Back up almost there, said a calm female voice over the radio.
Victim bleeding on the ground. I have a clear shot, Susan said. I'm taking it.
In one smooth movement, she aimed and she fired. Bam, bam! There came a howl from closer to the hospital entrance. Susan leaned left to evaluate the damage she'd done. Crack! Susan sprawled backward, her gun and radio skittering away from her hands. Her shoulder began turning red. I was so shocked I couldn't draw breath for a long moment.
Officer down! Officer down! Kathy said into the radio. She no longer sounded calm.
I'm going to help her, I said, gathering myself to rise.
You are not, Kathy told me. You are not moving at all. You're no doctor. You're no nurse. You're fodder.
It was the most crushing telling off I'd ever received, and I knew she was right. But looking at Susan lying on the pavement, bleeding, reaching her right hand across her chest to staunch the blood spreading in a creeping circle from her left shoulder, well, it gave me the worst feeling of helplessness I've ever had. I wanted to start screaming myself. Mr. Redding was staring at Susan, his mouth wide open, his color gray.
Officer is down east of a red Nissan, Kathy added. Approach from the east, keep low. One shooter's down, said Brad Rodenheiser. I can see him from my window, crawling west, leaving a blood trail.
Susan had stopped him.
Can anyone verify the location of another shooter?
It was a new voice.
I'm almost there. Safe to approach?
Another new voice.
Coming east from the perimeter of the parking lot,
a man said.
No more signs of another shooter. No more signs.
Stop and check everyone trying to exit that parking lot, said an older man.
searching civilians.
I figured out the incoming officers were stopping the fleeing civilians in case one of them was another shooter.
This was horrible. I had tears welling out of my eyes. I'm so scared, I whispered.
Young lady, you've never been to war,
Mr. Redding said, and then he fainted. Kathy, I said.
She turned a little and took in the scene. She spoke into her radio again. All I could do was straighten Mr. Redding out and unbutton his collar and remove his tie.
Parking lot secure, said a disembodied voice.
Shooter in custody, said a voice I'd heard before. Repeat, he is in custody. Gunshot to the abdomen, waiting for lockdown to be reversed.
10-4,
dispatch radioed.
There was a pause. Then that first voice said,
Kathy, you need to come in ASAP.
Kathy turned completely white.
She reholstered her gun in slow motion, and as an EMT crew swarmed over Susan, thank God, Kathy began walking away. I started to ask her what we should do, but I didn't. It seemed best to keep quiet. Then another team of EMTs crowded around Carter Redding, and I told them the little I knew about him and what had happened. Mr. Redding was unresponsive, and they put him on a gurney and began pushing it through the phalanxes of cars to reach help. And there I was, alone in a parking lot, swarming with police and civilians now trying to reach their cars to get the hell out of this place. I was so glad I had my phone. I called Robin and started crying.
Please come get me, I said. Please come get me.
He asked me questions, but I could not seem to get enough breath to answer him. I saw a familiar face and headed for it. Officer Rodenheiser looked 10 years older than he had an hour before.
Did you see what happened? He asked.
I shook my head. I had to gasp for enough breath to answer him.
I was with Kathy. I saw Susan get shot, and Mr. Redding passed out.
I had a hard time making sense. I finally managed to give him a narrative that satisfied him.
The kid with the gun was Kathy's nephew? I asked, finally.
Brad nodded.
We'd suspected it was Duncan who fired into that house party last Saturday night, but we couldn't build a case against him. Duncan's mom, Annette, is Kathy's sister. Dr. Clifton is the one who put Duncan's mom in the hospital.
But why would the boy start shooting?
Kathy thinks Duncan believes Dr. Clifton was lying about Annette's strange behavior, which was what landed her in the psych ward.
Brad Rodenheiser shrugged.
I guess Duncan practiced with the rifle between the party and this afternoon. Clifton's in surgery.
There was no upside to this, no redeeming quality. Everyone lost. There were a lot of people to pity today. I stood alone and shocked while Brad made some notes and prepared to interview other witnesses.
Roe!
It was Robin, being held back behind a thrown-up barricade at the main entrance to the hospital parking lot.
I had never been happier to see someone in my life. Can I go home? I said.
I would have pleaded if necessary.
Yes, we may have to talk to you again, Brad said. Goodbye, Ms. Teagarden.
Officer Rodenheiser, I said, bobbing my head.
After that curious formality, I hurried over to my husband. Maybe I should have gone back inside to check on my mother and John, but what Kathy had told Mr. Redding was true. The people inside the building had been the safest people in town. Chapter 15. By that night, the town had exploded with news trucks and reporters and curiosity seekers. I was glad to be at home with my family. I wasn't going to talk about the shooting to anyone. I was very upset about Susan Crawford. I saw her fall over and over again. The next morning, I ran down my list of acquaintances to find someone close enough to Susan's family to have reliable information. The wife of the brother of Susan's baby daddy worked at my mother's real estate agency. Mother had sold the majority of the firm to a group of her agents,
though she kept a small percentage of the profit. And from time to time, she dropped in, just to remind them she was still around and watching. The new receptionist buzzed Brenda instantly. Brenda said hello with that pleased anticipation that told you you were going to make her day.
"Brenda, this is Aurora," I said.
"I'm glad to hear from you. How is John doing?"
"He's better, thank you. Hanging in there. I called to ask about Susan."
"She had to have an operation yesterday," Brenda said. She sighed heavily. "But she's gonna be okay, and the baby's going to be okay. At least, we think. She'll be off work for quite a while. Her shoulder's pretty messed up."
"Is she very shaken?"
I couldn't find exactly the right word. "She hasn't been talking much because of the pain meds. I think every law enforcement person in the county has stopped by or sent flowers or a card." Brenda paused. "I couldn't ever do that job. I admire her."
"Me too,"
I said. "Please let me know if there's anything I can do."
I saw it.
I felt tears welling into my eyes at the remembrance. "Yes, I was shaken up plenty."
"Oh my God," Brenda said. "Oh, Ro.
I'll tell Susan you asked about her."
"Thanks."
I felt better after I hung up. The papers and the TV were raking into Duncan Carson's life, leaving no stone unturned. His mentally ill mother and his absentee father were presented as negligent parents who let Duncan live in a world of fantasy and violence. Naturally, a lot was made of the fact that the shooter's aunt was a police detective and had actually been on the scene. Kathy didn't talk to the press. At least momentarily, the public focus veered off the death of Tracy Beale and the disappearance of Virginia Mitchell to explore the hospital shooting. Though public attention may have wavered, the police did not. Levon Suit called me that afternoon and asked me to come down to the police station with Robin.
"Why?"
I was very reluctant to go anywhere close to Spakalek, with the media scrutiny so intense.
"There's someone I want you to see," he said.
"And you're not telling me who that someone is? I don't know why I should oblige you, frankly." Robin, who'd been vacuuming his office, drifted into the family room and waited for the end of the conversation.
"Ro, we want this situation to end as much as you do,"
Levon said.
"Kathy's got to focus on her family for a couple of days, but she's still monitoring the case. I'm trying to keep the momentum going."
"What momentum?" I would have liked to know what he considered forward progress. Solely because Levon Suit had been my friend for many years, I very reluctantly agreed to do as he'd asked.
"Come at 5, please,"
he said.
"Both of you."
"If Philip is home to keep the baby," I said. Philip, who now almost envied the kids who had been at the party last Saturday night, got home in time to watch Sophie, who had just filled up. Robin wasn't happy about this meeting, or whatever it was.
"Maybe we should get a lawyer,"
he said as we climbed in the car. I tried to explain that Levon had framed the whole request in terms of Kathy's personal disaster, but Robin didn't think that made any difference. To me, it did, but to Robin, Levon was playing emotional dirty pool. We were glad to see that the press seemed to be away from Spakalek. Maybe they were having a happy hour. I cheered up, and so did Robin. We scooted in the front door of the station and asked for Levon. He came out to greet us and led us back into the detective's area. We paused by his desk while Levon talked to another officer who'd been standing before a door with a small rectangular window embedded with wire mesh. An interrogation room.
"Here you go,"
Levon said, beckoning. He opened the door with a flourish and gestured for me to walk in first. I looked at the man sitting at the scarred table. He was younger than me by at least 10 years, and he had a lot of curly black hair and a noble mustache. He stood politely, and I saw he was dressed in a nice shirt and khakis. He was looking at me with as much curiosity as I'd shown him. Robin came in right on my heels. Levon had stepped to one side, and he was looking from one face to the other. Hello, I said, at a loss.
Carlos Rivera, ma'am,
the stranger said. Nice to meet you. I'm Aurora Teagarden, and this is my husband, Robin Crusoe. The other's shoe dropped. Oh, are you Virginia's half-brother?
Yeah, that's me. You the lady she was working for?
Robin reached around me to shake Carlos Rivera's hand, and they nodded at each other in a manly way. I know, you must be so worried. Your poor mother. I shook my head in commiseration.
She's very upset.
He looked down at the gray metal table.
We both are.
I sat down opposite him so he could resume his seat. How could you be any other way? We think so highly of Virginia. I'm praying she shows up soon, safe and sound, and explains what happened.
You don't think she's dead?
He seemed hopeful. I'll believe the best until I find out different. Now I understood why I was here. Levon had wanted to verify that Robin and I had never met Carlos, and that he had never seen us. I met Levon's eyes. He looked down. It was impossible to separate Levon's job from his behavior. I couldn't be his friend and, at the same time, his suspect. Our old friendship was simply dissolving, and I couldn't think of any way to save it. That was the sum total of our conversation with Carlos Rivera. Robin and I left as soon as we could.
I'd like to punch Levon,
Robin said as we drove home. I would be glad for you to do that, I said. Please let me watch. That might not be fair or right, but it was how I felt.
At least I was there,
he said bitterly. Oh, no, we weren't going there again. But as it turned out, we were.
You got shot at, and I wasn't there,
Robin said.
Another thing I wasn't around for.
As we pulled into the driveway and he turned off the engine, I tried to think what to say to him. He started to open his door, but I put a hand out to stop him. Robin, how can we ever know what will happen next? You'll have your share of times, I'm sure, when I'm not around and something big hits the fan. I will never blame you for not being omniscient. Please don't blame yourself. It doesn't make any sense at all. He leaned over to kiss the top of my head.
You're sounding wise. I'll try to work my head around this, but I'm still mad at everyone, including myself.
I know, I said, smiling. I love you. Robin managed to give me one of his wonderful smiles in return, and he put his arm around me as we went to the front door. Philip was holding Sophie, and she was tuning up for a howl. He was glad to hand her over. Again, Sophie stayed awake after her feeding, though I'd been sure she'd be exhausted after the crying jag. We put her on the floor under her play gym and sat there watching her with endless fascination. We may have taken a few pictures. Robin maintained that Sophie looked like his mother, Corinne, and Sophie did have the reddish fuzz that signaled Crusoe. I really liked Robin's mother, but I figured Sophie looked more like, well, like me, frankly. Since Corinne was 9 inches taller than me, we'd certainly find out which one of us was the blueprint, sooner or later. For a while, we had a pleasant respite from worrying about John, the dead woman, the missing Virginia, and the thief. Being a mother is making me selfish, I told Robin. I do get concerned about other people, and I get sorrowful when they suffer, but basically, as long as our family unit is okay.
I know what you mean. I don't think it's being selfish, exactly. If it is, I'm guilty too. I think it's just that our priorities have changed.
I nodded, feeling obscurely better now that I knew that Robin shared my altered worldview.
What do you think about having another one of these?
Robin said, laying a finger on Sophie's head. He was smiling, but he was serious.
We watched as Sophie, in a white and pink-flowered sleeper, waved her little fists and made "eh" sounds in a wholly adorable way. Even more adorable now that her eyelids were fluttering shut. She kept opening her eyes again, but she wouldn't be able to keep that up for long. "I can't believe we had her," I said, trying to buy some time. Since the doctor had assured me I couldn't get pregnant, a false diagnosis that had changed the course of my life significantly, as far as I was concerned, Sophie was a miracle. I could tell that Robin was waiting for my answer. It might be too soon after my delivery to ask me that. Having Sophie was an eye-opening experience.
I could tell.
Robin looked a little queasy at the memory.
And I know it's awful soon to even think about it, but you're 37 and I'm 40. If we want another baby, we can't wait long.
Are you really so anxious to have another child?
I had lost my peaceful mood and I was beginning to tense up.
First you want a puppy, now you want a baby? When will it end? I tried to sound like I was joking, but I don't think I even came close.
Robin could tell I was unhappy, but he forged ahead.
He must have had this bottled up for a while.
She's just so great, he said earnestly.
Maybe two would be even greater, so Sophie wouldn't be an only child.
I was an only child. I think I turned out all right. True, I had a half-brother, but we had never shared a household.
I guess since I have two sisters, I thought Sophie would maybe feel a lack.
I gave him a narrowed-eyed look to indicate I thought that was a crock.
By the way, Robin said, a quick change of subject.
Okay, and none too soon.
Mom knows traveling with a little one is a huge pain, so she wondered if we could have Thanksgiving here. She enjoyed it so much last year, she said to tell you.
We being... He looked very anxious.
The whole family. My sisters, their husbands, the kids, Mom.
9 people plus us plus Philip. I took a deep breath. Sure, we can do that. Maybe I'll get the meal catered. I'm not promising everything will be made from scratch. But I'll be glad to be hostess. We'll have to plan it like a campaign, a list of jobs for each day leading up to the holiday.
Great!
Robin looked so delighted that I felt guilty. His entire family had come to our wedding, but they couldn't stay long since it was inconveniently and hastily scheduled to take place between Thanksgiving and Christmas. Corinne had returned a couple of months ago after Sophie's birth. She'd stayed 3 days, getting to know her new granddaughter, and she'd been a tremendous help. Apparently, the second child discussion had been tabled. I was relieved. I had to admit, Sophie was so spectacular, the world could sure use another one like her. But the prospect of birthing and raising a second baby made me tired just thinking about it. Sophie conked out after 3 more minutes. I sat on a stool at the breakfast bar island considering our dinner options. I was gonna have to cook. That meant a trip to the grocery. I pulled over a pad and pen and planned 3 days' worth of meals, and the list grew and grew. Robin volunteered to make the grocery run.
The least I can do is walk around the store, he said.
I like your attitude, I said. All the cooking I did these days was easy. My hours in the kitchen had waned as my new job as Elsie, the milk provider, had waxed. Incidentally, now I couldn't eat onions or lima beans. Sophie got gassy if I did. I thought that was weird. Robin collected our cloth grocery bags for the store and some clothes to take to the dry cleaners, and I armed him with my list. After he'd left, I thought longingly of lying down for a while with a book. I didn't have to clean, since tomorrow would be the maid's day, another treat I'd given myself. I was really into treating myself post-Sophie. I couldn't cook until Robin returned. Yes, I could read. My cell phone rang. I looked at the caller ID. Mother, I said. What news?
Ro, he's better, she said instantly. He's fully awake. The doctor seems very optimistic now.
My shoulders sagged with relief. I'm so glad, I said. Any idea how much longer he'll be in the hospital?
At least another day. More tests, more observation.
The hospital was the best place for John right now. My mother would run herself ragged taking care of him when he came home. Ida Brattle Teagarden Queensland had high standards for everything, and maintaining a husband was included under that banner.
Please let me know what I can do, I said. Cook or run errands, whatever.
Thanks.
By the way, John David tells me he saw Carter Redding in the ER after that awful thing in the parking lot. Carter said he was sheltering with you and Kathy Trumbull. Is that true? Are you okay?
I wasn't getting the full Ida laser-focused questioning only because John had higher priority right now.
You don't need to worry about me, I said. I was safe the whole time.
Thank goodness, Mother said.
I don't think I could take more bad news.
You'll have to tell me all about it soon.
You didn't hear the shots?
No. The nurses just told me I couldn't leave, but I wasn't going to anyway. And I stayed in John's room until they told me the situation was over. They didn't tell me what had happened. I was actually in the hospital, but I never knew a thing.
She sounded a bit bemused, but not really concerned.
I wanted to keep it that way.
I'm fine, I said stoutly. If you can, find out how Mr. Redding is doing. He didn't look so good when they took him into the hospital, and he was really brave during the whole incident.
He told John David it was like being back in the war.
I hope he's okay.
I'll try to find out, honey.
Thanks, Mother. Tell John I said hello.
I'll do that. The joy was back in her voice.
Now I felt too restless to read. I roamed around the living room, picking up discarded newspapers and putting them in the recycle bin, throwing away outdated magazines, reshelving some books in the library in Robin's office. As my mother would have put it, I was piddling. I was completely taken aback when Philip emerged from his room with Sarah in tow. They didn't seem self-conscious or embarrassed, and I tried to be the same. I called myself an old stick in the mud and several other names.
It was just that I didn't know she was here, I told myself. I hope that was true.
Hey, I'm running over to Sarah's, Philip said. I'll be back by supper time. 7?
I glanced at the clock.
Sounds about right.
I'm glad you're okay, Sarah said. I heard about what happened in the parking lot.
Do either of you know Duncan?
I had a possible source of information right here at hand, and I hadn't even thought about it.
I do, Sarah said. Not well. I didn't like the people he was friends with. You know how that is.
Sure, I said, wondering if I really did remember how that was.
So, did people talk about him? Was he very strange or something?
She hesitated, looking at Philip as though communicating with him.
There was that thing,
he said maddeningly.
Sure. Duncan was at the last big party I went to, 2 or 3 weeks ago. He didn't usually come, even when he was welcome to, but he was there with a couple of boys I don't like, because they're posers. Like, they're so dangerous.
She looked mildly contemptuous.
Well, after Duncan turned out so crazy, maybe they really are.
She shrugged.
Anyway, this other guy showed up, an older guy, maybe in his 20s. None of us had ever seen him before, and Duncan left with him. I didn't see the older guy again, but Duncan came back all smirky, and you could just tell he'd done something he thought was really radical. He told a couple of friends of mine that he'd bought a rifle. Duncan said he was going to give it to his dad for Christmas.